We will call this meeting of the Commerce Committee to order. Thank you for all being here mostly on time. Representative Sanders, if you want to come on down and we'll get started on your first bill. And while he's on his way down, Representative Murdoch, have you had a chance to look at the minutes from yesterday's hearing?
Yes, I have, Mr. Chair, and I'll move the minutes. They look perfect.
Thank you. Representative Murdoch, or actually I should say we should thank Bethany then. Representative Murdoch moves the minutes from yesterday's minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Murdoch. Representative Sanders, if you want to go ahead and move your bill and start telling us what we need to know.
I don't have a list in front of me. Which one would
you prefer? 2093, I believe, is first. The contractors.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move that House File 2093 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Taxes.
Feel free to start whenever you're ready. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. House File 2093 addresses issues resulting from independent contractor exemption certificate program legislation that left a major loophole in allowing for worker misclassification. This bill replaces the ICEC program with a pilot contractor registration program. And just from the outset, let me be clear that if you are already registered and meet the registrant requirements with DALI and DEED and the Department of Revenue, this bill does not harm you. If you're already registered, there are no additional requirements to register, or if you're already licensed, you are in good standing as far as the registration goes. If you're a worker or companies that are operating above board, complying again with DALI D, the Department of Revenue, you simply have nothing to worry about, and we'll do. You don't need to do anything additional for this bill. In 2007, the Office of the Legislative Auditor released a report, and that report stated that we have a major problem of misclassification of employees in the state of Minnesota. They found that, obviously, using independent contractors instead of employees can significantly reduce organizations' labor costs, which in many cases is a great situation. However, when employees are misclassified, employees as independent contractors, misclassified workers are denied benefits and protections that should be available to them. The OLA found that an estimated 14% of Minnesota employers subject to unemployment insurance taxes, or 1 in 7, misclassified at least one worker in 2005. But they also consider this estimate to be fairly conservative because it excludes employers that fail to register with the unemployment system. The agency, the OLA, found that the agency's efforts to detect and deter misclassification ranged from limited to modest and were not well coordinated across those agencies, and primarily due to limits in state law. So the OLA recommended that DEED, DALI, and the Department of Revenue should work together with the legislature to standardize criteria, kind of have a global approach to this. They need to audit, coordinate their auditing and investigation activities, and make sure that DEED, DALI, and Department of Revenue should establish procedures to routinely share information about identified instances of misclassification, work with the legislature to resolve any statutory barriers in doing so. Believe that this bill does address the findings and many of the recommendations from the OLA report. Again, this is a pilot program starting July 1st of 2012 and expires on June 30th of 2014, with a report due to the legislature on January 1st of 2014. Requires an online registration. It maintains the longstanding 9-factor test to establish independent contractor status for workers. The application process is much better and more simple. There is no fee for anyone charged for any worker or company that registers during this pilot program. So the goal really is to make sure that people are registering. This bill also provides for penalties for failure to register, for hiring unregistered contractors, and for coercing others to form a business entity. However, the penalty for failing to register will be forgiven if registration is achieved within 30 days. This bill is meant to encourage registration and compliance. With that, I mean, the focus of the bill is making sure that we maintain safety, that we ensure that workers' comp insurance premiums are paid, that unemployment insurance premiums are paid, taxes are paid on the employment and the income side, and fair and appropriate wages are paid. So with that, I believe that this is a good bill, a good bipartisan bill that addresses many of these issues found by the OLA, and we ask for your support on the bill. Mr. Chair, we do have an amendment, if that's been circulated.
Representative Sanders, it has not. It's being copied right now, and it should be here shortly. I don't have anybody listed as wanting to come and testify on this bill for or against, but is there anybody in the audience that wants to come down and testify either in favor or be opposed to this bill? Representative Sanders, you're going to have to tell us stories from your youth then.
Trying to think about what could possibly be appropriate.
You're awfully short. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, might we start with 21 questions?
We could. Do members have questions on the bill while we're waiting for the amendment to come down? It should be here any second.
Mr. Chair, can he just sort of explain the amendment before? It might be technical, but if there's some substance to it, maybe you can just...
Good idea, Representative Atkins. Representative Sanders?
Sorry, I dropped my phone that has the actual amendment in it. That's what I'm doing down here.
We weren't going to ask.
All right. In the bill, let's see here. We had originally changed the term individual and inserted worker. In discussions with the Builders Association and the contractors, we have gone back to the term individual. Currently, also in the amendment as it's being passed out, there's a 2% withholding. That was a part of the ICEC program that is being deleted from the statute.
And Representative Sanders, if I might interrupt, that's why it now has to go to the tax committee, because of that 2% withholding that's in this amendment?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. We have changed how the registration is being done online in this amendment. For now, it's registration information public on the department's website, may be accessed for registration verification purposes only. We've added an additional indemnification clause in working with the builders and the contractors that adds additional comfort language for indemnity as well in this amendment.
And Representative Sanders,
I think
was this
most of what's in the content of the amendment?
Okay, and this was an amendment that came by way of discussions with the various interested parties.
Yes, that is correct, Mr. Chair. We've been working with the Builders Association, with the contractors, and with the Department of Labor and Industry on this amendment.
Members, any questions to the amendment? If not, we will vote on the amendment, get the bill in the shape the author would like it. Those in favor of the A5 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted to the bill, Representative Sanders. Now that we have the amendment on here, is there anyone in the audience that would like to come and speak for or against the bill? Not seeing anybody rushing down. Members, any questions about the bill? Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Sanders, just a quick question. Would this apply to
dollar one of someone, say someone was employed in a company or something and decided on the side they were going to start up and a business for themselves and do some occasional work. Is this dependent on the amount of money of that before someone must register, or would it be first dollar?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Loon. And I have Mr. Durenberger here from the Department of Labor. If perhaps he could give a little more technical. I have what I think is correct, but maybe if we have him actually give you the correct answer up front, that'd save us some time.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Sir, if you want to identify yourself for the record and start when you're ready, if you can enlighten us on Representative Loon's question, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Charlie Durenberger. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, work in the Construction Codes and Licensing Division. And to Representative Loon's question, there is no minimum dollar amount in here. It's similar to the requirements that we have for building contractor, electrical contractor, plumbing contractor licensing, which basically holds that before you start getting into this business of providing construction services, you do need to be either licensed or registered with us under this bill.
Representative Loon, does that cover your question?
It does. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Durenberger. Members, any other questions? Representative Stenzer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's fine. I'm just curious. I know, like in construction cleanup companies, sometimes they might hire a family member during the summer to maybe clean up a site for a home builder. And it might just be a couple hundred bucks for a couple days of work. How would that impact just like a family member or that would do just a small amount of work? It would be under $500.
Mr. Durenberger.
Representative Stenzrud, I think if it's a family situation, well, first of all, and you might want to ask the question more broadly, cleanup would not be considered a construction service. It would be covered under the bill. So we're looking more at people that are actually providing services to build or improve a building, whether it's commercial or residential. But under the current ICEC statute, we've held that cleanup services don't fall under that scenario. But if it's a family member, you know, for workers' comp purposes, a family member can do work as an employee without being covered for workers' comp. And so if they wanted to consider the family member an employee, they would not need to register with us.
Representative Stenzrud, does that answer your question?
Yes.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Durenberger. With that, Representative, was there any other question? With that, Representative Sanders, seeing no other questions, if you want to renew your motion that House File 2093 as amended be approved to pass and sent to taxes, we would appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do move that House File 2093 be recommended to pass as amended, be sent to the Taxes Committee.
Thank you. So, Representative Sanders, we are going to send 2093 as amended to the Tax Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Sanders. We'll send that on to Representative Davids. Why don't you stay up there, Representative Sanders, and tell us about House File 2335.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I'll move House File
2335.
I'll move House File 2335 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. If you want to go ahead and give us a brief summary, I think I see a visitor heading down to talk to you, talk with us on this bill as well. So if you want to get us started, go ahead while we wait for Ms. Cook to come down.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that deals with collection agencies and their background and screening process. I believe that the collection agency is a very important industry and that it's kind of the undergirding of our economic system, and that it's an industry that makes sure that folks that or people that make certain debts or have certain obligations, that they're kind of an industry that makes sure that our economic integrity is upheld. However, this is also an industry that over the years has seen, has seen bad actors, as in most industries, you know, there are good people, good actors, bad actors. But they've come under, a lot of scrutiny in the past, and in some areas for good reasons. But in this instance, we found that Minnesota law is pretty ambiguous, and we want to make sure that there are strong, clear guidelines and statute for how collection agencies need to act so that our consumers are protected as much as we can help them. Minnesota law currently requires collection agencies to, quote, establish procedures to follow when screening an individual collector applicant prior to submitting an applicant to the Commissioner for Registration, end quote. That statute does not specify what that procedure should look like or require any specific types of background checks to be done. In light of that, the Department of Commerce has taken recent enforcement action against a handful of collection agencies alleging their background check procedures were not adequate to satisfy statutory requirements. This has caused significant concern, I think, to a lot of the collection agencies, and similarly, I think, causes a lot of concerns to consumers as well, that there is not clear, bright lines established in statute as to what collection agencies must do in order to be in proper standing. My bill attempts to make it clear on what is expected of collection agencies when it comes to background screening. I want to make sure that there are clear, bright lines that are clearly defined and established to protect the consumers and to also let the collection agencies to know what rules that they need to apply by. And for those that are violating and choosing to violate those laws, then they should be held to the highest penalties possible. In summary, this bill requires criminal history record check and a statewide county search for all states of residence of the applicant within 5 years immediately preceding the initial registration. It also requires use of a vendor that is accredited with the National Association of Professional Background Screeners. It also requires an annual screening of individual collectors consisting of public record search with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension or the equivalent. In this bill, also, we add misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor convictions involving any financial crime to the list of disqualifications from collection registration. We also clarify that the applicant's responsibility to disclose if they have a civil judgment against them for failure to account to a client or customer for money or property collected by them. We also add a safe harbor provision which allows the agency 30 days to correct certain administrative inadequacies found by the department before a fine can be levied. I think it's important, again, that the industry know what the rules are. I think it's very important for consumers, for them to know what the rules are, and that collection agencies have clear lines that they need to follow when going through criminal background checks or background screening processes that are not currently defined in statute. So with that, Mr. Chair, if we have, I guess I could turn things over to Ms. Judy Cook, unless there are any initial questions. I don't know if you just want to answer questions or if you have any testimony.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. I don't see any questions. Ms. Cook, if you want to go ahead and fill in the blanks.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Girard Associates, representing the Minnesota Association of Collectors, better known as MAC, which is the trade association of third-party debt collectors in the state. We are here today in support of House File 2335. As Representative Sanders said, it adds needed clarity to the statutorily required background screening process for individual debt collectors. I just want to give you a little bit of background on this and also point to some information in your packet which does talk about the industry here in Minnesota. First of all, Minnesota is one of 38 states that requires licensure of the debt collection agencies. We are only one of about four states that actually requires any registration or licensure of the individual collector, and we have the most extensive requirements for the collector in the country. Prior to 2004, it was a licensure, and the department did the background screening that had gotten quite backlogged, and so we approached the legislature and worked with the department to pass a bill that changed it to registration for the individual collector and shifted the burden of the background screening to the agency. We, once that passed, and as Representative Sanders said, it didn't have a lot of specificity to it. We approached in 2004, after the bill passed, we approached the department, asked them for guidance on what they would consider to be an acceptable background screening procedure. We were told they would not give us any. Since that time, individual agencies have come forward, asked for general guidance, or asked if the department would look at their individual screening process and tell them if it was acceptable or not, and that was not forthcoming either. So we had not heard anything or any concerns from the department, and then in December 2010, there was an article in the Star Tribune which outlined some issues with respect to felons and other people with particular issues working at collection agencies. Subsequent to the article being published, we learned that those were either instances where the individual had committed the felony after they had been initially hired and the background screening had occurred, either that or it was an instance where it was not a crime that is disqualifies them from serving as a collector. And so the collection agencies had, in fact, done their job. And after that, the Department of Commerce, shortly after that article, sent consent, cease, and desist orders to the agencies listed in the article, indicating that their background screening procedures were inadequate, requiring them to submit their policies to the department for review. The department conducted audits and negotiated consent orders with these collection agencies, including some very significant fines. The agencies agreed to the settlements because they wanted to put this issue behind them, but not without some significant impact to the agencies. And also, there is confusion among the rest of the industry about what is required under the law and what the department deems as an appropriate background screening process. So the core of the issue is that we really just want to know what the rules of the game are, and tell us, and we'll do our very best to follow them. And as Representative Sanders said, if there are bad actors or there are folks who are not complying, then absolutely the department should go after them. But we, you know, right now it's a guessing game, and if they guess wrong, there are pretty serious implications. I won't go through the bill because Representative Sanders did, but I want to be clear that the association is not trying to weaken the statute at all. In fact, we've added a provision that was not there previously that would disqualify anyone with a gross misdemeanor or a misdemeanor for a financial crime. So that is added consumer protection. And also, we did include a safe harbor for any administrative penalties, such as this, feeling that if there is any lack of clarity in the list that we've got there, or the department feels like an agency is not meeting the requirements of the statute, that they would have 30 days basically to cure, to make good on it. And if they don't, again, it is appropriate for the department to go after them. So we believe this is very important to ensure that Minnesota's law provides appropriate guidance to the collection agencies, provide important consumer protection, and help the agencies who want to be in compliance with the law so that they actually can comply with the law without fear of being told by the department that their procedures are inadequate. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Sanders,
if it's appropriate now, we do have an A1 amendment that perhaps we could take care of at this time.
I think this is an excellent time for the A1 amendment. Representative Sanders moves the A1 amendment. Do you want to briefly explain
why
we have it and what it does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment deletes Section 1. It's our intent to streamline some paperwork requirements, but we're willing to remove it because of concerns expressed by the Department of Commerce. It's our hope that in meeting with the Department of Commerce, these are some of the concerns that they had mentioned, as well as, it's my understanding, I think that this bill went through the Senate Commerce Committee, and this amendment would also line the bills up. It reinstates language in Section 4. So the new language regarding misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, financial crime encompassed fraud. The department is concerned that the word fraud itself was being deleted, so we've agreed to reinstate that clearly. We also narrowed the safe harbor right to cure language in Section 5. Our intent was to allow agencies 30 days to come into compliance for alleged administrative violations. The department correctly pointed out there was a statute citation included that should not have been. So we removed that citation and worked with, I think it was Senate Council time to narrow down the applicable statutes to ensure that we're only applying this provision to administrative or technical statutes. And then further amend language in Section 5 to make it clear what a licensee has to do to satisfy the requirements of a new provision. So that is a brief explanation of the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Representative Atkins.
And thank you, Representative Sanders. I'm just trying to fit the new language into the bill and wanted to make sure that I understood it. basically the operative portion that I'm talking about is line 1.9 through 1.12 of the amendment, and which gives the collector 30 days to remedy certain problems. That's so if we're not talking about things that they knew were a problem or that they should have known were a problem. It's just if you get what I'm saying. I mean, if they absolutely knew that they had a bad egg working for them, if they should have known they had a bad egg for them, this isn't protecting them from that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. It's my intention, if the Department of Commerce has even tighter language, we believe that it addresses that issue, that if you are acting in good faith and what you believe the statute says and you are knowingly acting in good faith and the department says, hey, you're not, that would be the type of example. But if you knowingly are doing something wrong, then it would be my intention that obviously if you're knowingly breaking the law, that you would have to suffer those consequences.
And Representative Atkins.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, I get that. Obviously, I think the standard needs to be a little bit higher than that. I mean, if you're knowingly breaking the law, that's, I think everybody in the room would understand that. But also, if you should have known, if you hired a background company that you knew was crap, that had did a bad job before, you hired them anyway because it's that sort of scenario that I want to make sure that we're protecting against as well. And I haven't read the amendment close enough, I guess, to know if it gets at that. But is that your intent as well? If it's just a matter of tweaking the language slightly to address that issue, then I don't think we got an issue. If that's not your intent, then that's something different.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. I would say that is my intent.
Yep.
Okay, to make sure. Yeah.
Representative Atkins.
Then, Mr. Chair, I think this might be it. I guess I'd look to smarter folks down to your left to make sure that the language is what it's what the author's intent is, and then I suspect that to the extent that the department has concerns about that may help allay their concerns. And I'm talking mostly about Representative Dowd. Yes,
that's what we all assumed. Mr. Pender, is that
and Representative Anderson and Representative Anderson.
Mr. Pender, is that substantially what the language says, and is it accomplishing what will make the department happier and what Representative Sanders is looking to do?
Mr. Chair and members, I guess thinking about what Representative Atkins said, this language seems as if it would apply to any alleged violation, no matter how serious or unserious it is.
Mr. Chair, that's what I was afraid of. I didn't think that was what the author, based on his explanation, I don't think the amendment is exactly reflective of what he was trying to describe and what he supports. And I think my guess is we're all moving in the same direction. It's not an argument, it's just we want to make sure the language says what we're trying to say.
Well, Representative Sanders or Ms. Cook, is this the recommended language that came from Senate Counsel?
Yes, Mr. Chair, which there couldn't lie the problem.
Well, I yeah. see right there. An issue. Ms. Cook, do you want to?
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, I do want to point out the changes in line 1.5 and 1.6 of the amendment. What we tried to do was make it very clear that we are only talking about the administrative activities of a collection agency, a collector, as opposed to violating some of the other, extensive state and federal laws in terms of the actual collection, acts of collecting. But obviously, we're happy to talk with the department of any changes that they want to suggest. And if we need to tighten this up a little bit, the idea is generally folks really trying hard to comply with the law, believing that they are doing so, and then learning from the department that in fact it is not adequate under their, what their expectations are.
Do we have? I see Mr. Reich is here from the Department of Commerce. Do you want to come down and give the department's opinion or your take on this?
Thank you.
Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Reich. If you could officially identify yourself for the record and help us out, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. John Reich from the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I want to say thanks for allowing us to testify today in front of the committee. I would like to also thank Representative Sanders for the amendment. I've had good conversations with both authors in the House and the Senate. Some of the items that I've raised in meetings with them have been addressed through the amendment and I think have made some headway. However, at this point, we still oppose the bill as amended. And I talked to Representative Sanders about this yesterday, and we have committed to working with the collection folks, Mac and Ms. Cook and Ms. Sarah Strong-Belisle, to see whether or not we can come to a resolution on the matter and indeed clarify the rules of the road as has been set. With respect to the right to cure issue, some of the items that are caught in the right to cure include the licensing and registration section, which is the screening process requirement, and then the notice that the commissioner be given written notice of a change in personal name, company name, address, or ownership less than 15 days. And the other pieces are, you'll bear with me for a minute, notification of the commissioner if a collection agency licensee shall notify the commissioner of any employee termination within 10 days of termination if it is whole in part based on violation of this chapter. And the last one is 2.42. Verified financial statements and record keeping. So those are the items that are currently caught under the right to cure, to be clear. Those are items we'd like to continue to discuss with the author and the proponents of the legislation, but at this point we remain opposed.
Thank you, Mr. Reich. Is this amendment, the A1 amendment, is that a step in the right direction? Is it something, as you continue to work with the author and the proponents, is this going the right direction?
Mr. Chair, I believe it is.
Would you, and we will, well, let me ask it this way. Can we put this amendment on, pass it? Can you continue to work with Representative Sanders on this and Ms. Cook and the proponents?
Mr. Chair, whether or not to pass the bill is up to you. But I can commit that we will continue to talk with the proponents.
Okay. Does the department have, and feel free to check on this and get back to us, does the department have concerns that the language in the amendment is still too broad, or is that one of the things that needs to continue to be worked on?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, the some of the language and some of the issues that I raised with Representative Sanders and Senator Thompson do still deal with the language that wasn't addressed with the amendment. As I said, it's a step in the right direction, and we'll continue to chat with them.
Representative Atkins.
And I think, Mr. Chair, that sounds good, at least on this part of this side, to me anyway. The what my sense is that we just have hopefully just a drafting kind of concern that can be addressed, because as I read it, and I've now read it a little bit more closely, you've got a safe harbor that potentially swallows up the entire rule, where 97.9% of all collectors are great. Maybe it's 99.7% of all, but you get that one bad apple that is doing something knowingly wrong, or at least they should have known that they were doing wrong, and they get caught doing a bad thing, and we go in and we say, oh, we caught you doing this bad thing, which we think you maybe even knew you were doing bad. And they have a get-out-of-jail-free card. You know, I'd expect better of my own children, and I'd certainly expect better of professional collectors, who most of them do a great job. So I think once that gets cleaned up with that direction, I think we're all going to be on the same page and we'll have a good bill. And if it moves out of here with the direction that they keep working on it, I think that'll work just fine.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly agree with what Representative Atkins just said, but listening to Mr. Reich, you said that even with the amendment on, if that all gets cleared up there, you still oppose the bill? Is that correct?
Mr. Reich.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, as currently drafted and amended, yes.
Representative
Davis. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Reich. Even if the amendment gets straightened out, because I agree with Representative Atkins that we don't be driving trucks through this thing. I mean, it has to be what Representative Sanders intends here. So even then, you would still oppose giving collection folks some guidance as to what they can and can't do?
Mr. Reich.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, we are not necessarily opposed to giving the collection agencies guidance as to what they can and can't do. The devil, as you say, is always in the details. There are a couple of other items in Section 2, for example. We're not sure. And if you'd like me to walk through the rest of the bill, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to, and perhaps
sure.
That would help answer your question, Representative Davids. In Section 2, you have a registered individual collector must give written notice of a change of address at or name at annual registration or renewal. That is a departure from current law, which says that an individual registered collector must give a change in personal name within 15 days. And we're not sure that that is a changing that standard is something that we're comfortable with. When we think about changing our names, it likely was when we all got married and had to go through the federal government and change Social Security cards and things like that. With respect to some criminal activity, when folks change their names, it's to continue to perpetrate criminal activity under an alias or a different name. So that's something that's important to us that we'd like to look at. Subdivision 8, Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, the screening process requirement, I can appreciate the collection agency's idea that they'd like to have some certainty around the screening process requirement. And the screening process at initial registration is different from the screening process at renewal of the registration 1 year later. It's more stringent at initial registration than it is at renewal. That's something that we'd like to look at over the course of 12 months as somebody is, as a registered collector, they may engage in something, some nefarious activity, and the screening process at renewal only does a search for the BCA, which would only encompass Minnesota. So if you're commuting from Wisconsin, you wouldn't necessarily catch some of the things, perhaps. That's something we'd like to talk about further. In Section 4, there is language added under number 3, that a civil judgment does not disqualify an applicant for registration under this section or under Section 45.027, sub 7, clause 4, unless the civil judgment is for failure to account to a client or customer for money or property. That's also currently a departure from current law that says that no civil judgment may be levied against you in order to be registered. That's one of the criteria. It's a public policy call, I think, as to whether or not civil judgments other than ones relating to failure to account to a client or customer for money or property are should be considered, I guess. And then lastly, Mr. Chair, we talked about the safe harbor, which is...
Well, thank you, Mr. Reich. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Reich. I mean, I hope we can get this bill out of here. I think it's a good bill, and you know, Representative Sanders is great to work with, and I'm sure he'll be happy to work with you. But I think it would be in the department's best interest to tie some of this down, because these collections, we just had one in the Department of Revenue, and now another one from the Department of Commerce, where they were told one thing, do it this way, and I'm not saying you're a wonderful guy, but I understand that. But Department of Revenue, it just happened in Tax Committee today, where they were told one thing, and then the department audited and did just the opposite. Huge losses of money for this company. They may go out of business. Collection agencies have been told to do something by the department. They do it. Then they get investigated, and then they are fined or whatever. Now, Mr. Chair, Mr. Reich, what do you have, like a penalty schedule, or when somebody's going to get fined, like these companies getting fined $250,000? Who made that up, or do you have a chart that says if you do this, you get penalized this, or how does that work,
Mr. Reich?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, I believe it is in Section 13. Current law, 13 or 14, as in one of those sections of current law which outlines what a state agency may penalize people for. There's a cap, I believe it's $10,000 per violation is what the cap is on penalties for state agencies. I'd have to look into it further, Representative Davis, but there are caps. I think it's Chapter 14, which specifies the what a state agency is and the definition thereof and other things, that it also goes on to talk about penalties and things like that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. Mr. Reich, and we can talk about that further later. My biggest concern, I think this is a very important bill, because we have to lock it down what these folks are supposed to be doing. If we've got bad actors, I say nail them to the wall. Just nail them. But to be out there and not have guidance as to what you can and can't do, you believe that you're complying with the law, and then the department comes and says, oh, we don't like the way you complied with the law, and then they levy a huge fine. That's not right. That's just not right. We have to tie this thing down and get, you know, and I'm sure, like you said, there could probably be some changes made here, but these collection agencies have to know where they're at, and then they have to comply with the law.
Mr. Reich.
Point well taken, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Reich. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And really, my comments were largely along the lines of Representative Davis. I think, you know, this is a highly regulated industry, both from the federal and state level. And to achieve compliance, specificity in the law in this area is an important way to do that. So I think to that point, and the one that Representative Davis really, I think, honed in on well, I think it would be good for the department and the collection agencies to figure this out and to put that specificity in the law, because then it's very clear what the expectations are, and we would expect those companies to follow that to the letter of the law. So I would encourage those discussions moving forward.
Thank you, Representative Loon. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to sound like I'm piling on with my colleagues here, but I tend to agree. This could also be a barrier to entry for people who are trying to determine whether or not they want to start a business in the state of Minnesota that deals with collections. If the lines aren't, as Representative Sanders pointed out, bright lines on here, it does make it difficult for someone to choose to start a business of this nature in the state of Minnesota. I know that the department regulates a number of other industries where the definitions of licensure and protocol are clear in statute or in rule. So I would hope that we'd be able to get this resolved as well so that we could continue moving and leaving the playing field level and not providing barriers to job creation in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reich, I kind of am curious on the whole fee schedule piece of things, too. If you can share that information with the entire committee, I think that would be helpful to know. But I had some additional questions along those same lines. Can you tell me, since 2011, how much in fines in this area in particular the Department of Commerce has collected?
Mr. Reich.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't know offhand. I'm happy to get back to you.
That would be great. There's a couple other questions along those same lines that if you could provide some answers. I'm just curious, and when you're looking at that from 2011, how much has been collected, if you can do a five-year comparison as well of how much fines were collected in the previous 5 years, I think that would be helpful to know, too. And the other thing, too, is do you know where does the fine money go? Does that go to the general fund? Does that go to the Department of Commerce? How does that work? Can you tell me?
Mr. Reich.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that I do know. That goes to the general fund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Reich, does the Department of Commerce get a percentage of that based upon the fines that are charged? How does that work? You know, sometimes do you know it all, or how does that work?
Mr. Reich.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, no, and that's very much on purpose, I think.
Mr. Reich, I think I know what you're saying, but just to clarify, no, Commerce doesn't get a percentage?
Correct. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry,
Representative. No, that's...
My sense is that the reason that we don't is to wall off any sort of personal gain or investigatory power in order to fund IT over here or something like that.
Right.
You know, that'd be my...
I think that's logical. Yes. Boy, everybody at Commerce has a brand new copier all of their own, you know, that kind of stuff.
So that's, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I think that was the intent of it. I, of course, I probably was a twinkle in my dad's eye when it was written, but that's right. I think the intent is behind it going to the general fund and us not seeing it.
Okay.
Representative Anderson.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Reich, do you know what percentage of the general fund goes to the Department of Commerce?
Mr. Reich.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's an excellent question. Our general fund budget is in the neighborhood of $50 million per year. And there's a $36 billion budget, 35.2, excuse me.
That was just to test you, Mr. Wright.
Mr. Chair, I was not a math major.
It's all good.
This really hurts right now.
There's a lot of sympathy with you, Mr. Wright. Representative Anderson, is that?
Just Mr. Chair and Mr. Reich, I do appreciate the efforts that Representative Sanders is trying to do here. You know, I'm surprised that the department hasn't considered doing this as a legislative initiative. I would think that rather than having this done through a rulemaking authority, that you'd want to have this set in a statute so that there is transparency for all of these individuals, because the more information that we can provide them, the easier it is for them to comply. And I know it has been in the practice of the Department of Commerce in the past, is that we want people to be able to comply. We don't want to be a punitive. We want to work with them to help them be in compliance with the laws that we have in place. And I think that this bill helps to achieve that.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Other questions from members?
We have some fractions and decimal questions we'd like to ask of Mr. Wright, too. But
could we make those into a continuing education question for everyone at Commerce?
Oh, no.
Mr. No. Chairman, please, no continuing education.
If we're going to get it going, let's really get it going.
Okay.
Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to come down and speak in favor or against? Or, Mr. Reich, is there anything else you wanted to add, or Representative Sanders? I'm not seeing anybody rush down. Members, any other questions on this? Well, I think, did we vote on the amendment? I thought we voted on the amendment. Well, let's do it again just to be on the safe side. Representative Mullery is saying no. Well, actually, he's shaking his head no, but the tape doesn't convey that, so we'll trust him. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Amendment is adopted. Representative Sanders, to your bill, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would certainly appreciate everyone's support on this, and Representative Atkins, to your point, certainly I've already conveyed to Mr. Reich that we will have conversations and meetings to tighten up the language. I do think that's important, but certainly would appreciate your support. I think it's important for several reasons to make sure that there are clear guidelines and kind of bright lines, not only for the agency so that they know how to comply, but so that consumers are protected and we can more easily find the bad actors in this industry. With that, members, Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 2335 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register.
Thank you, Representative Sanders, and I think I speak for everybody in the committee, and we appreciate your willingness to work and Mr. Reich's willingness to work with you and Ms. Cook and others to make sure we get it right. Thank you for that. With that, Representative Sanders renews his motion that House File 2335 as amended be recommended pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Sanders. Representative Kiefer. Representative Kiefer, if you want to go ahead and move your bill, House File 2308, we would appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move 2308, recommend that it be passed and referred to the Civil Law Committee. House File 2308 has bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate. It's also supported by the Minnesota Mortgage Association, which used to be the Minnesota Association of Mortgage Brokers and the Mortgage Association of Minnesota. They merged. Also, the Bankers Association, Community Bankers, Credit Union Association of Realtors, State Bar Association, and the Department of Commerce. Although after the last testimony, I'm not sure I want to include them as supporters. But anyway.
We always want their approval and their to work with them, Representative Kiefer.
Okay. And we, you know, This is just kind of like tightening up another loophole. It seems to be the theme today. There's something called Chapter 58 licensees, and they can take advantage of a loophole that's in some legislation that was passed several years ago. And the legislation is really just supposed to help homeowners who are really in trouble with foreclosure. And basically, it's just asking that money not be collected before a promised service is provided. And at this time, I'd be happy to have Mr. Elwood answer questions.
Thank you, Representative Kiefer. And we have always admired Mr. Elwood and most of all his brevity. Well, Mr. Elwood, welcome to the committee.
I did shorten your thing. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Ron Elwood, Legal Aid. The only thing I'll say is I'd like to thank Representative Kiefer for bringing forward this bill. I'd like to thank you for hearing it and signing on to it. And Representative Atkins and Mazarell, appreciate the co-authorship, and Mr. Dwight for his help. And I'll answer any questions.
Well, Mr. Elwood, I was kidding. If you do have something you want to say on the bill, please feel free to do so. But can I ask either one of you a quick question first? Representative Kiefer, you said you wanted this to go to civil law?
Yes.
Is that does it need to go to civil law? I'm fine with that, but I just did you hear that from that committee? It's okay. I'm fine
sure,
with it.
I mean,
I'm checking.
Okay with a bill being vetted out.
Okay, that's fine.
As much as possible, make sure it's a good bill.
Mr. Elwood, do you have something more you want to say? I didn't mean to. I was just joking. Board members, if they have questions for Mr. Elwood. Representative Davids.
Thank you. I was just wondering, you know, you've been around here a long time, Mr. Elwood. What committee did you first testify in?
Seeing no further testimony.
I'll pass, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Elwood, feel free to
answer
that.
I would like to answer that question. Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, it was actually in this committee, and my recollection of that day is painful, not because of the chair, but actually the chair was extremely gracious to me. I was sitting here with my knees shaking and holding onto the table. Absolutely awful, most awful testimony you could possibly imagine, and then Chair Davids told me I did a good job, and I told him I know he was being nice, but so I'll always appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Elwood or Representative Kiefer, anything else you want to tell us about this bill?
Mr. Chair and members, very briefly, what this does, so you know what you're voting on, is. The issue here is that loan modification providers that ask for fees from homeowners to modify loans have been obtaining Chapter 58 licenses and thereby under the law becoming exempt from the requirements of Chapter 325N. And all this is saying is, even if you have a mortgage originator license, you still have to follow the law. So that's the gist of this bill. We found that these loan modifying companies are trying to skirt the requirements, and it's real simple. And it shouldn't affect any traditional mortgage originator or broker or servicer because they're modifying loans through their contracts with the lenders and not charging fees. So it really should not cause any problem. In fact, as Representative Kiefer mentioned, the association that represents that organization is not opposed. And I would also just like to thank all the stakeholders that Representative Kiefer mentioned before for working with us and giving us the green light to go forward with this bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davids.
To Mr. Elwood, I would just have to say I think you got a good bill. I think Representative Kiefer has a good bill here. And this time you really did do a good job testifying.
Members, any other questions? Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to come down and speak for or against this bill? Please identify yourself for the record and start whenever ready.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, and also lead the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium, where we try and cover the broad array of services and have professionals in our group covering the whole housing spectrum. I just wanted to raise a few issues with this committee so they could think about it, as Representative Kiefer was saying, to vet some of the issues and see how we might deal with it. First, I do have a number of credentials in the housing area. I found that even with an MBA, I had to go and take certifications. Now, I am not licensed as a mortgage originator. However, I do have certifications from the Congressional NeighborWorks America, who provides training for HUD-approved agencies and HUD-approved counselors. Of the foreclosure courses, Minnesota only requires one course. Nationally, to get national certification, a special certification that's almost like getting a college degree, there are four or more, and I have taken a number of them, so I know more than just your basic foreclosure 101. And I wanted to raise a few issues just because of things that are coming up in these different coursework and the discussions there. First of all, you talk here about the differences between a foreclosure. I think in a number nine, a foreclosure counselor versus you're calling them foreclosure consultants. What you have a list of what a foreclosure consultant includes and what it doesn't include. And to the general public, and the way that we talk about ourselves sometimes too, the terms are used interchangeably, whether it's called a consultant, a counselor, an advisor. So there was confusion for me at first. And then I was looking at what they could or could not do, and I'm going, hey, there's crossovers. And because the section of law you're changing also talks about penalties and misdemeanors, I think it was misdemeanors or something like that, we would be concerned about the net, the broad net that you're casting, that we don't get some of these other counselors who are more advanced in that broad net. And the reason I mention that is because there has been conversations as far as some of the foreclosure counselors being called mortgage originators. Now, it depends on what the state, how they defined it, and how they defined the duties. So this, again, would cause us some confusion. As far as charging a fee, Mr. Elwood was talking about they don't charge a fee. And when HUD had no funding in their budget, they were telling the counselors there's a point where we charge a fee. Now, for basic intake for foreclosure counselors, if you're just getting half an hour of service or 1 hour of service, no, you don't charge a fee. But if the case gets more complicated for the more advanced counselors, they start charging fees. There's a number of nonprofit organizations and nonprofit counselors who are charging fees. So I raise that as an issue because we don't want to catch them in the net. They're really trying to help the people. And so otherwise, I'm concerned, too, because with the broad net, the counselors are going to be afraid to help with the loan modifications they can do. And they're just going to say to the consumers, we can't help you. Your best choice is move, let it go through foreclosure or sell your house, get into a rental apartment, or move in with others, which really isn't what we're trying to do. We're trying to help the consumers to the extent possible. And I understand you're trying to catch the criminals and those who misuse the system, but I am concerned about the broad net you're catching and the direction that the counselors are going at the national level and how that affects all this. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Representative Kiefer, do you want to comment on that, or did you take notes of that?
I did actually take notes, Mr. Okay. Chair. Thank you. And the one mentioning of a nonprofit counselor, according, I think it's the 325N.04, number 9. It's a, their nonprofits are exempt.
Okay.
So even if they charge a fee,
that's what it's showing in here. And we can, like I said, we could begin to
Well, why don't we, if you can meet, it sounds like briefly with Ms. Lee after this. Mm-hmm. Is that okay, Ms. Lee? I think we just have a difference of opinion here. Other questions, members? Is there anyone else that wants to come down and testify for or against? With that, Representative Kiefer will give you the final word on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I think that the best thing to do is vet these things out thoroughly, so I'm glad we're putting it to civil law, so I'd ask that the committee pass it into civil law, and we'll keep working on it.
That sounds good. Representative Kiefer renews her motion that House File 2308 be passed unamended and send it to the Civil Law Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Kiefer. Representative Atkins, you know what? It's getting kind of late.
So I'll be very brief. Why are you laughing over here? You don't think I got it in me?
Representative Atkins, if you'd like to go ahead and move House File 343, and why don't we do the, after you move it, why don't we go right into the amendment, and then we can talk about the bill.
I think, Mr. Chair, that would be great, because the amendment is that peace in the valley thing that Representative Davids always tries to find. I'll move House File 343, be recommended passed, and referred to the, should we just go to the consent calendar of this, Mr. Chair? General Register?
They told us General Register. I'll do what General I can to have it calendared ASAP.
I like that. So we'll move that, and then, Mr. Chair, I'd move the DE2 amendment, which is an author's amendment that will put the bill in the shape that I'd like to proceed with it.
Representative Atkins moves the DE2 amendment. Members, do we have questions on that amendment? Getting it in the shape the author would like. Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The DE2 amendment is adopted. Representative Atkins,
and
fire away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be very brief. Members, you may recall we had this bill up for some lengthy and perhaps some of the most compelling testimony that the committee's ever had last year. There were a number of people that have been impacted by online frauds, telephone frauds, where they use wire services to transfer a ton of money. In fact, in yesterday's news, literally you can't go more than a week or two without seeing something about this in the news. And until relatively recently, a year, year and a half ago, I thought there was nothing you could do about it. We're not talking about the Nigerian scam where you get, you've won $1 million and you just have to respond.
Whoa, scam?
I'm sorry to break that to you. I actually responded, however. To one of those. I'll tell that story later, but got into about a three-day deal back and forth with one of these folks, and I thought it was my nephew just lost in London. It's much, much more sophisticated than that. And as we've learned in the last year, there's organized crime ties. It's a very, very sophisticated operation. What I would, with the committee's indulgence, I have Mr. Arlt here from the Department of Public Safety, who I think may well know more about this than anybody in the state of Minnesota. And rather than have a whole bunch of, you'll recall last year we had lots of people come through, I thought just 5 minutes from him kind of bringing us up to speed on where things stand today. I would like to, as he's walking down, give some credit to the wire transfer folks that I've been working with over the last several months who've been cooperative. And we may not have seen completely eye to eye, but I think we see eye to eye on this amendment, and it's a good step forward in the right direction that they have agreed to. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Alt and let him kind of walk you through where things stand today, and then hopefully a relatively rapid move through the bill itself. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Mr. Alt, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and let us know what we need to know.
Mr. Chair and Representatives, my name is Jim Arnold. I'm a senior special agent for the state of Minnesota in the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. My law enforcement career started in 1978, and I've been with the Department of Public Safety since January of 91. On behalf of the Department of Public Safety, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today about fraud-related crimes where the victims here in Minnesota and the suspects can be located throughout the world. These typically are designated as mass marketing types of financial crimes. Just to review a little bit of last year, we started our program by doing a study in the spring of 2007. And to be honest with you, we started it on the basis that we got tired of telling Minnesota citizens there was absolutely nothing that we can do, because we were getting a an increasing amount of phone calls from senior citizens and their family members and saying, look, my, you know, I won a prize up in Canada, and at that point in time, it was mainly focused out of Canada, and I sent off money. Now we need you to go out and collect this money for us because these crooks aren't giving it to us. And as things went along and when we studied this crime and what we were able to identify, there were things that we could, and not only that, but we should do, and that we started to do in the fall of 2007. And to attempt to end up keeping this fairly brief, since the fall of 2007, we have received over 100,000 complaints just here in Minnesota. In the last 2 years, we've handled crimes totaling over $5 million per year. This crime is traditionally severely underreported. The National Center for Against Fraud up in Canada reports that typically it's reported at about a 5% rate. And within that, about half of those individuals will lie about whether they actually sent any money. So within your packet, there should be three pages of information from the Federal Trade Commission. And within that, I'd like to point out a few things. One is that the reported fraud complaints received by the Federal Trade Commission increased in the last year, an additional 175,000 complaints to 990,242. Even more compelling is that over a 10-year time period, the Federal Trade Commission shows that the number of fraud complaints has risen steadily from 137,000 to the present 990,000 complaint level. Page 8 of the Federal Trade Commission report shows that there were 126,903 fraud complaints, that the method of payment reported was through a wire transfer. These 126,903 complaints were 50% of the fraud complaints received by the Federal Trade Commission where the monies were lost and it was reported by what method. The amount listed as paid or lost through the use of a wire transfer is over $442 million reported through the Federal Trade Commission. And again, this is a severely underreported crime, so keep that in mind as we're talking. Our agency focus has been since 2007 in the area of foreign lottery sweepstakes and prize giveaway, and the reason for that is we were gambling. You know, it had a gambling nexus. Again, nobody was dealing with this crime. So we picked it up and actually started to run with it. With dealing with it, as Representative Atkins said, we've been finding out that from our international law enforcement counterparts that these criminals involved in these scams are typically associated with organized crime. The groups that we think of out of New York City, the groups that are out of Eastern Europe, West Africa, Jamaican gangs, one of our more notorious outlaw motorcycle gangs, and other similar type of groups. But on the other hand, our victims are the elderly. They're not sophisticated necessarily all the time. Some of them are vulnerable. They lived most of their life during times where a specific area code meant the phone call was actually coming from that part of the United States. So they make some of their decisions when they decide to end up getting involved in these, with these types of backgrounds. They pay for caller ID and actually believe that the telephone number that shows up on their phone might be real. They seem to believe that if they write a specific location on the money transfer form, that that's where their money's going to go. And so they also then believe that law enforcement should be able to track this money very quickly. None of those things are true. They become easier victims because the technology has possibly passed them by. And sometimes it's simply because they've regressed to the point of being a vulnerable adult. Traditionally, this crime has been severely underreported, as I said. In fact, most of the victims have a hard time reporting it to law enforcement, have a hard time deciding where to report it. And that's another reason why our program was started, where we attempted to provide Minnesota citizens with a one-stop shop and also to be a expertise place that where we can end up working with local law enforcement as to how to handle these crimes. And as Representative Atkins said, the little bit of news release that went out yesterday where criminals were arrested over in England because of a crime that originally got reported to us out of Rice County is an indicator of what can happen with these crimes and that they can be followed up. People can be arrested. They are all the time. As I look through as far as the members here, if you'll just indulge me for a few more minutes, I looked up your different districts. And I just checked our report database as to what's occurring in your district. And I'd like to end up letting you all know that basically all of you have districts where you have people who have been reported as victims. Most of you have victimization, well over 30 victims in your areas. Representative Davids comes out probably the best. He's got under 10. So either they don't know about us down there or they're not following about over some of these scams. And probably the biggest victim I could find as far as in the district of anybody who is actually here would be Representative Sarah Anderson. She had $250,000 loss victim. And within that, we were able to follow up on that, get part of the money back. And I believe those individuals, which was a group operating out of Canada, will be going to trial. And I probably will end up going up to testify on that this summer. So can these things be done? Absolutely. We can go after them.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a very interesting subject, very sad subject. But one of the reasons mine is so low is because a lot of my constituents don't have any telephones. I have a tremendously large Amish community. And
I suppose.
I'm serious.
Yeah.
Somebody said the other day, well, David, you know, half of you guys don't have electricity or TVs. And I went, that's true.
Yeah. Is everyone else picturing a horse and buggy with a Vote David sign on the back?
In black and white.
Absolutely.
Hopefully it doesn't cover the slow-moving vehicle sign. But
No, let's not go there. That's not
yeah. But anyway, just to end up going on as far as what is actually happening today that we see. Out in southwest Minnesota, I've got a victim. The case is on my desk now. The money transfer reports is probably over 2 inches thick. The victim lost somewhere between $800,000 to $900,000. The family, in trying to address the situation, got frustrated to the point of cutting her phone line and flattening her tires just to attempt to get their mother to quit sending money. And this isn't non-typical of what we see with family members, because they don't know how to go about getting their family member, get them to stop. One of the provisions that's in this bill is to self-disqualify. And hopefully within the language of the bill, it will allow those with power of attorney to file on the family's request to get the person to self-disqualify. But we have victims, again, all across the state, and it is very sad to deal with on a regular basis. We started the program with a supervisor, three special agents, and an analyst. We now have significantly less resources that are assigned to this. So probably our efforts will be a little less in the future unless there is an adjustment made by the Commissioner of Public Safety as to end up how to handle these efforts and to fund the efforts.
Thank you. Mr. Arrow?
Yes.
Do I remember, and maybe I'm remembering this from somewhere else, did you tell us last year that part of your effort involved working with churches around the state to educate their elderly parishioners, or am I getting that from somewhere else?
Mr. Chair, representatives, we work with churches, we work with any senior groups, we work with those that work with seniors. Any possible way to end up education the populace, including educating law enforcement around the state, we will find any way imaginable. We will find any way imaginable that we can end up to get this message out.
Thank you. Members, any questions for Mr. Arrell? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? Seeing nobody coming down. Members, any other questions? With that, Representative Atkins, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And normally I just say please vote for it. I did note in your handout AARP also sent a letter in support. It's either a priority or the top priority for AARP. The person that was going to testify on their behalf got snowed in today. Imagine that. So I did want to at least note that they had sent a letter. With that, members, I'd appreciate your support and will renew my motion that the bill, House File 343, as amended, be recommended, passed, and referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Representative Atkins renews his motion that 343 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Members, I think we are adjourned. Thank you very much.